The Greatest Day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Episode 14 of The Greatest Day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories details the events of the 1940 season. All-Ireland champions Kerry were looking to defend their crown and in the process go joint top of the Roll of Honour. Throughout the programme, we'll reproduce extracts from the Kerryman newspaper. Gary O'Sullivan's will be the voice you'll hear each time.
Part 1.
Kerry had regained the All-Ireland crown in 1939, edging out Meath on the famous day that they wore the colours of county champions Dingle. It meant that should the Green and Gold win the Sam Maguire in 1940, they would join Dublin at the top of the Roll of Honour with 14 All-Ireland senior football titles. 1940 saw Gone with the Wind win 8 Oscar awards. Neville Chamberlain resigned as British Prime Minister to be replaced by Winston Churchill. 6 people were killed by an IRA landmine at Dublin Castle. And the man who has long since regarded as the greatest soccer player of all time, Pelé, was born. As defending champions, the Kingdom would have been viewed, by the outside world at least, as the team to beat in 1940. It's natural for the title holders to be thought of as contenders for the following season's championship. However, such ambitions looked unattainable ahead of the Munster opener.
As the song says, it is a case of the old familiar faces. Amongst the possibles and probables all jumbled together, there is not a man who has not previously played in some capacity for the county. The student of form will ask himself the question on reading the names. I wonder, is there another All-Ireland in them? The answer is no in regard to some of them, while there are others listed not up to senior county standard. It would be better to face up to these facts at the very start before the championship begins and thus save ourselves from the hallucinations later on. Let it also be appreciated that the list is the best we have got. The old familiar faces cannot be replaced for the present at any rate.
Kerryman writer P.F., the legendary Paddy Foley, also offered up an interesting theory that Kerry may have been behind the decline in the standard of football across Munster.
Limerick, Cork and Tipp were once noted football counties, but in recent years they concentrate more on hurling. Many believe that Kerry's football preeminence in the south has caused the Munster hurling preference. In other words, Kerry footballers attained such a high standard that the neighbouring counties gave up kicking the bigger ball as a bad job. Many old Gaels will tell you that Kerry has killed Gaelic football in the south. No longer can a county be a serious All-Ireland contender under both codes. It would seem, furthermore, that where one game has established a definitive ascendancy over the other, the weaker threatens to become submerged eventually.
The ultimate honour of winning the Sam Maguire may have been deemed a long way off. However, there were no such doubts when it came to provincial honours. Well, up until the Munster final anyway. Limerick provided the opening obstacle, and Kerry could call on two-thirds of the previous season's All-Ireland final winning side. Missing were Bill Dillon, Bill Casey, Paddy Kennedy, Charlie O'Sullivan and Tim Landers. Jim Bourne Fitzgerald of O'Rahilly's was brought in to the half-back line. Dingle's Paddy Bourne Brosnan, who had missed virtually all of 1939, was named at midfield. North Kerry's Tony McAuliffe and Jimmy O'Gorman of Mitchell's were brought in as wing forwards. Another Tralee man, Sean McCarthy, was named in the corner. There were two Jay O'Gormans on the Kerry team against Limerick, the aforementioned Jimmy of Mitchell's, as well as James from Stax. The James of Stax is the man better known as Jimmy Gawksy. The Kingdom, led by stalwarts including Bill Myers, Joe Keohane, Tom Gega O'Connor and Johnny Walsh, dispatched Limerick on a scoreline of 4-9 to 1-2.
Gawksy Gorman and Tony McAuliffe wided in turn before a free by Mert Kelly to Gawksy Gorman was saved on the goal line. Kerry were granted another free. Kelly took this again and judged the wind neatly for a Kerry point. Mert Kelly again secured the goal kick and a nice centre from a difficult angle was well held by Dan Spring, who sent in a hard grounder to the back of the net for the first major score of the match. Mulvihill was robbed of possession by O'Connor. The latter sent to Jimmy Gorman, who shot hard and low to the net. Brown brought off a great save in the Limerick net, however, at an expense of a 50. Jim Bourne Fitzgerald got possession a few minutes later and sent to the wing. Gawksy Gorman raced out and shot a grand point over his head. Tom O'Connor secured Healy's clearance and crossed a neat ball to Tony McAuliffe, just outside the square. The latter punched in a Kerry goal. Paddy Bourne Brosnan soon after placed Gawksy Gorman for another neat point. Cotter was pulled down in possession in front of the goal, and Tobin sent the free kick well and truly between the uprights. Kerry came back from Joe Cuhan's goal kick. Johnny Walsh sent to Dan Spring, who placed Tony McAuliffe for a point. Another Limerick rush was stemmed by Eddie Walsh, who sent to Goxie Gorman. The latter parted to Dan Spring, and Spring was pulled down while making for the goal line. Jimmy Gorman pointed the free. Nocton's goal kick was sent back by Tony McAuliffe. Dan Spring secured and dribbled past two defenders before sending neatly between the uprights. Just before the short whistle, Jimmy Gorman received, and he and Dan Spring ran 40 yards in a hand-passing movement before parting to Goxie Gorman, who punched into the corner of the Limerick net for a deserving goal.
Kerry's advantage was 3-6 to 2 points at the short whistle.
Kerry took over on the resumption. O'Connor had a point within 5 minutes. Colbert, Stack and Cotter handled in a neat movement, the latter sending in a grand goal for Limerick. The Limerick team crumbled at this stage. Kerry had it all their own way. O'Connor took a free from midfield. Tony McAuliffe was fouled while rising for the ball. O'Connor took this free also and sent to Jimmy Gorman, who shot hard into the Limerick net. Down came Kerry from the goal kick. Goxie Gorman centred, Spring secured and pointed. Kelly again returned the goal kick to Spring, who finished the scoring with a neat point.
4-9 to 1-2 was the result. 16 points in the difference.
Kerry's superiority was never in doubt. The first half was fought strongly by both sides. Kerry's greater experience enabled them to pile up a formidable score. Limerick, however, put up a spirited fight, and it was only the extraordinarily sound defence of Cuhan, Myers and Healy that saved the Kerry net on a few occasions. Altogether, the game was one-sided. Kerry's flying start and strong lead in the first half demoralised Limerick, who allowed the former to pile up further scores on the resumption to win by a convincing margin.
That comprehensive victory secured a Munster semi-final with Tipperary.
In 1928, Tipperary last beat Kerry in the Munster Championship. Our men beat them repeatedly before and since. Notwithstanding this long sequence of Kerry victories, not one of them was secured easily. Though the scores often point otherwise. Tip are always a tough team to beat. A tough, rugged team. Dour championship fighters who never let up. Still, they must show a big improvement in their form of recent years to beat Kerry. But it would be foolish to underestimate them, and Kerry should line out at full strength, prepared for a hard hour. Our men will get that, no matter what the final scores are.
Jim Bone Fitzgerald, Tony McAuliffe and Mitchell's duo, Sean McCarthy and Jimmy O'Gorman were all dropped for the game with Tip. Dingle pair Bill Casey and Bill Dillon returned to strengthen the defence considerably. Their fellow clubman Sean Brosnan came in at centre-forward. Paddy Kennedy from O'Rahilly's was the fourth person drafted in. He started at midfield, with Paddy Bond Brosnan moving to the half-forward line.
The Kerry selection is the best we have got at the moment. One hates to see Tim Landers off. He is not the player he used to be. But in point of years, there should be a few good games in him yet. As yet, he is not active. He could not be considered. Charlie O'Sullivan played a star game, according to reports, in the County Dublin final last Sunday. Charlie is still young, but for want of training has slowed up and put on a lot of flesh during the past year. A return to form of their sharp-shooting Kitog would be very welcome to the Kerry attack, which is certainly the weakest section of a team strong in all other sections.
Landers would not feature at all that season. O'Sullivan only in the All-Ireland final, but what a cameo role it would be by O'Sullivan. As with Limerick, the game against Tip was in the bag by half-time.
The game opened very tamely, neither side putting forth any great effort. Then Kerry went on the attack, and the Tip goalman brought off a few fine saves. Tip tried to break away, but they could not pass the Kerry half-line of Dillon, Casey and E. Walsh. At centre, O'Connor and Kennedy were in control. O'Connor sent in long, raking balls to Tip territory. One of these was got by Dan Spring, who passed to Mort Kelly to raise the first white flag. Goxie Gorman soon followed with another from a free at a very difficult angle. About 10 minutes passed with poor kick-about football when Sean Brosnan played Goxie Gorman for a goal. Johnny Walsh quickly followed with a point. Tip had a point from a free and Kerry hit a goal by Dan Spring. He soon had another. Leading by 13 points to 1 after 20 minutes play, Kerry rested on their oars. Kerry had an occasional pot shot at the post to raise another flag and sent many other efforts wide.
At the turnaround, the Kingdom led 3-5 to a point, a case of going through the formalities in the final 30 minutes.
The second half was a repetition of the first. The match mainly resolved itself into a kickabout affair. Kerry had brought their tally to 17 points before Tip had another flag. The end of a one-sided, poor game, which does not call for description, came with the scores 4-8 to 1-5. A cynic would probably describe the game as a farce. He would not be far wrong. Any person who paid a bob for admission got very poor value for his money. Make no mistake about it, it was not Kerry's football brilliance which made the semi-final a veritable farce. At no stage could Tipperary make any impression on their opponents, who won almost at will. It was one of the worst displays put up by Tipperary for a long time, and spectators were leaving the grounds long before the final whistle.
With Tip put to the sword, Waterford were all that stood between Kerry and Munster honours. It was a barrier that was expected to be easily overcome, but there was a familiar warning for anyone contemplating overconfidence.
The result for the senior final is regarded here as a foregone conclusion, a foolish frame of mind perhaps, but inevitable. I doubt if many people will follow our seniors to Waterford. They will wait for Croke Park, as per Kerry custom. Let us hope these cocksuredness will not lull us into a false sense of security. The Waterford men have done nothing to warrant their being regarded as serious challengers to Kerry. The champions will be expected to win well, but nothing should be taken for granted. Should we qualify for the All-Ireland semi-final, our prospective opponents from Ulster will rouse interest. It surprised us that Antrim should have held Cavan to a draw recently, but the Breffni men made no mistake last Sunday. It always appears to us that, like Kerry in Munster, Cavan have no serious rivals in Ulster football. It is only when Cavan slip or have an unusually bad team that some other county wears the Ulster crown. Cavan looked like holding it this year.
The sole change by Kerry for the Munster decider saw Tony McAuliffe restored at the expense of fellow North Kerry man Johnny Walsh. Kerry actually trailed by 3 points at half-time against Waterford. Despite this, the post-match Kerry man headline read, "Champions were never extended." Kerry mustered just 2 points in that opening period against Waterford.
Waterford won the toss and played with a stiff breeze in their favour. In the third minute, Lonergan at centre field put Waters in position, who pointed for Waterford. After a hard struggle around the Waterford post in the 10th minute, Mert Kelly had hard luck not to register a major, driving the ball a shade wide of his objective. Some few minutes later, from a Waterford midfield free taken by Lonergan, a stubborn tussle eventuated around the Kerry post. Moylan received and put Dalton in possession, who, under pressure, kicked an overhead ball over the Kerry crossbar. Dalton came into position and shot a hard high ball for the goal. Dan O'Keefe jumped across the goal mouth to ward off a major score, but tipped the ball over the bar to raise the point flag for Waterford. Play was transferred to the other end following the kick out for Mert Kelly to reply with a point. Dalton, from a Waterford free 15 yards out in the 20th minute, pointed for Waterford. Waterford now made a desperate attempt to goal. Moyland gained possession from a midfield tussle and races away to pass to Waters. Waters sent in a high ball. Bill Myers, in a tense moment, saved Kerry from immediate danger by flashing from the right wing and tipping the ball wide to concede a 50. On the resumption of play, following the resultant wide, Kerry struck the Waterford post in their first effort to score, and Kett brought about two marvellous saves. Kett was called upon to save his post on two occasions in the ensuing goalmouth tussle, the ball going wide after striking the upright. Kerry now went all out to score, and their efforts were rewarded by a point per Tom O'Connor, close on the half-time. Lonergan, on the resumption of play, drove high into the Kerry backline for Moylan to receive and point for Waterford. Veal, in splendid fashion, saved what in all probability would have been a goal for Kerry on the half-time whistle by dashing between the posts, Kett being unsighted.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
Waterford led by 5 points to 2 at half-time against Kerry. However, the Daisies would add just one further score in the final. Meanwhile, the Kingdom proved just why they were the top dogs.
The champions had matters decidedly in their favour. Following an 8 point by Brosnan from a free in the second minute, they never looked back and forged ahead despite Waterford's defence, which, though quite good, was unable to withstand the pressure. A minute later, Gawksy Gorman again reduced Waterford's lead by a point. Kerry had many opportunities of scoring, but by faulty kicking did not avail of their advantages to the full and sent wide several times. The Waterford defence was, for a short period, stormproof, but in the 10th minute, Tom O'Connor evened up affairs by pointing for Kerry. Brosnan, some few minutes later, sent Kerry ahead by a point. Kerry, at this stage of the game, though not in any way extended, were in top form. In the 17th minute, the Kerry forwards had the defence outwitted and were crowded around the Waterford goal line. Sean Brosnan received following an exciting scrimmage for possession and tapped the ball beyond Kett's reach. This was the deciding score and Waterford seemed to give up all hope to emerge victors. Spring missed narrowly, striking the Waterford post, but some few minutes later pointed for the Kingdom. Near the close of this half, this player again increased Kerry's lead by a point. Shortly after this score, McAuliffe crossed to Kelly, who shot hard for a goal, but a point resulted in Kerry's favour. Kerry, with decided advantage, began to ease their vigilance and only put up a show when their territory was in real danger.
Kerry were Munster champions once more. On this occasion, they had claimed provincial honours thanks to a scoreline of 110 to 6 points.
Waterford's strong defence and the splendid goalkeeping of Kett were the deciding factors in Waterford's favour. They changed over at half-time with a 3-point lead, and though unable to hold their own, when faced by the famed passes, brilliant combination and overhead movements of the Kerrymen, one factor to their credit was that they were the only team to hold Kerry without a goal in the first half. On the turnover, Bill Dillon, Sean Brosnan, Murth Kelly, Dan Spring and Goxy Gorman were in top form and broke down all resistance somewhat easily at times. Only for erratic shooting by our front row, Kerry's winning margin would have been much bigger. Still, one should not criticise accuracy in a game of this description. It has never been the Kerry policy to pile on the agony on a beaten foe. And did their situation warrant it, many of those Kerry-wise last Sunday might have found their mark.
Cavan were to be the opponents in the All-Ireland semi-final, and a different proposition entirely to what Kerry had encountered in Munster.
Cavan will be a far tougher nut to crack than any of the teams we have met in the South. I wonder what preparation the players are making for the match on Sunday week. Many of them have room for improvement.
Even allowing for such apprehension, confidence was high that the Kingdom would once more overcome their arch rivals of the 1937 decider.
During this season and last, Cavan have been team building. They had a series of trials with the object of finding another All-Ireland 15. Nevertheless, some 10 of the 1937 Cavan team will again wear the royal blue next Sunday. 8 of the Kerry side are still to the good. It will be observed that 5 of these are in defence. O'Keefe, Cohan, Myers, Dillon and Healy. There is no shadow of doubt the team is stronger in defence than attack. Forward accuracy appears the doubtful section of the side. One thing is certain, the team is built, experienced and confident, not the experimental team of Garsoons which faced Cavan in the 37 final. Since losing to Kerry in 1937, the Cavan men have done nothing. It should be hell for leather from whistle to whistle, and may the better horse jump the ditch. I am confident that horse will be Kerry and that the Kingdom will once again qualify for the All-Ireland.
1940 saw the introduction of the rotational system for All-Ireland semi-finals. Prior to that, there was a set system, which was somewhat lopsided. For the 15 seasons leading up to 1940, the breakdown of who the Munster champions played in the All-Ireland semi-final read as follows. Connacht 6 times, Leinster also 6 times, and Ulster on only 3 occasions. For the Munster final, Tony McAuliffe had been selected in the half-forward line, ahead of fellow North Kerry man Johnny Walsh. The roles were reversed for this All-Ireland semi-final against Cavan.
The Kerry selection contains no surprises, as the local championships produce no fresh material. While little criticism will be heard of the composition, the placings of the players may cause a difference of opinion. One suggestion would be to play Tadhg Healy at centre-half. He's a big man and scopy footballer and would have more room to operate in that position. A further improvement might be to have Tom Connor and Johnny Walsh change places. Walsh does horse's work in every match and is the ideal midfield man. Connor is so accurate that he should be moved closer to the post. Forward accuracy appears the doubtful section of this side.
Surprisingly, given the many chances on offer at either end, the game was goalless at half-time. Cavan had the better of matters on the scoreboard, but only just.
Under the drop of the ball, Paddy Kennedy got it. He parted to Mort Kelly, who lobbed to Sean Brosnan, and the opening white flag went up for the champions after 4 minutes had gone. JJ O'Reilly got the kick. He left with Paddy Smith. He sent a great cross to Stafford, and there was a tremendous cheer from the Northern contingent when the ball sailed over the bar for the equaliser. The pitch was as slippery as a skating rink after the recent rains, and the players had great difficulty in holding their feet. Cavan came in a grand passing movement, and from a point-blank range, Boylan crashed for a goal, but O'Keefe saved well. Kerry went off along the wing. Paddy Bom Brosnan passed to Gawksie Gorman, whose shot hit the upright. Gorman got on the clearance, and a fast grounder to the net saw the goalkeeper dive to the fast-moving ball and turn it round the upright for a 50. Johnny Walsh secured Tom Connor's free. He was fouled, and from about 30 yards range, O'Connor sent up the white flag, putting the champions in front. Kerry went away in a headlong rush. Johnny Walsh passed to Dan Spring. Spring sent a cannon shot towards the goal, but the keeper punched it wide for a 50, another great save. Cavan had a free. Tom Riley's kick was got by Paddy Smith. He banged to the net, but Dan O'Keefe was again to the fore with a wonderful close-range save. There was a tremendous tussle near the Kerry post, but Cavan had another free. Smith made no mistake with the greasy ball, which passed just above the bar, and the scores were level at 2 points each after 28 minutes of rousing football. Paddy Bom Brosnan crossed in front of the sticks. Mort Kelly rushed in and boxed towards the net, but his Ulster namesake was to the fore with a sparkling save. Tom O'Connor stopped Cavan at the critical moment, but his kick was bottled and Paddy Smith secured to drive the ball straight between the uprights for a minor.
That score put Cavan ahead by the minimum at the break, 3 points to 2. They went further in front in the second period, but Kerry, aided by some woeful defending, would be the ones to progress.
Right up the field went the Ulstermen to leave Smith in possession. He sent a great ball between the uprights, and Cavan were 2 points in front after a few seconds. In another Cavan raid, they had a free. This was followed by another close-up, and Paddy Smith drove straight to the objective for a minor, leaving Cavan 3 points in front. The champions swept down on the Cavan post. Dan Spring was in possession close in. He was pulled down, unobserved by the referee. But the leather never left the square, and Gawksie Gorman got his foot to it. The ball was fielded by the unbeatable Cavan keeper, Kelly. But he allowed the leather slip out of his hands, over his shoulders into the net. He waved his hands in a gesture of disgust. The scores were level, luckily levelled. Tom Riley's free was fielded by a Cavan man in front of the Kerry post. He was bowled over in possession. From the kick about 25 yards out, Paddy Smith sent the white flag aloft, and the Ulstermen were again in the lead. A long free by Healy was secured by Johnny Walsh. Off he went along the wing. He sent a clever pass to Gawksie Gorman close up. Gorman shot diagonally along the ground from the corner, and the slippery ball again went off the Cavan goalman to the net. Kerry now 2 points in front. Johnny Walsh got onto the ball and went off in a characteristic solo run. Clean through the defence he went, and finished with a scorcher that seemed to touch a Cavan defender on its way to the net. 3-3 to 6 points. Cavan came away in an unexpected loose rush. A great chance was lost when a forward drove wide along the slippery ground. Cavan sent back the kick out, and Cully drove over a minor. The kick led to a headlong charge by Kerry, Sean Brosnan and Mort Kelly handling, before leaving Johnny Walsh in possession to finish over the bar.
Cavan, architects of their own downfall, were out. Kerry had progressed their fourth All-Ireland final in a row, doing so on a scoreline of 3 goals and 4 points to 8 points. In the decider, they were to meet Galway, who on the same day and at the same venue had defeated the Meath side beaten by Kerry in the final the previous season. Galway's victory afforded Kerry the opportunity to avenge their 1938 final replay defeat to Galway. Before thoughts turned to Galway, dismay was expressed at the antics of the Kerry forwards against Cavan, this despite the side racking up a total of 3 goals and 4 points.
About midway through the second half, Kerry were in control, but the Kerry forwards proved a most inefficient lot, and at this stage should have raised many minor flags. Kerry owes victory mainly to their defence. Dan O'Keefe was better than I have seen him for many a day, and the three fulls were up to the mark. Tom O'Connor did a great day's work at midfield. The Kerry front line failed, allowing for Gawksie Gorman's goals, though Finnegan appeared to hold him a lot.
Assessing the Galway team and the Kerry man, Paddy Foley enlightened the readers as to the emergence of the Maroon and Whites.
One wonders if Galway's football resurgence does not date from governmental changes in this country. For the tricolour now replaces the Union Jack over Reanmore Barracks on the Galway suburbs, headquarters of the Irish-speaking battalion. It may be noted that Reanmore are army champions in hurling and football, defeating other barracks of vastly bigger size. University College are now a force in Galway football. Galway's Gael-sized university and Reanmore are now prolific sources of material for the Galway County team. Prominent footballers have taken up residence, like Flavin of Kerry and Beggs of Dublin. It used to be said of former Dublin selections that they included a man from here, a man from there, and a man from God knows where. One could say the same of the Galway team of today, not meaning to be disparaging.
Paddy Foley, who famously went under the moniker PF, offered up that Galway were underestimated when the counties met in the 1938 final. He proclaimed that such overconfidence would not be in evidence in this 1940 decider. Foley was also bemoaning Kerry's attacking division.
Kerry's forward problems remain. Unless our attack can be strengthened, it seems to be curtains for the champions. I don't believe Kerry's forward formation, as evidenced in the Cavan game, is equal to the task of getting through the Galway backs, notwithstanding that Hoban and Munnelly repeatedly did so last Sunday.
The game PF refers to is a Mayo versus Galway encounter played on September 8th, a fortnight before the All-Ireland final. In what was nothing more than a challenge match, Galway were defeated 113-107. A bullish Galway supporter had his letter printed in the same week's Kerryman newspaper.
Acorra, I read your comments about our Galway team with much interest. It seems to me that you are aware Kerry is facing another licking and that you are kind of preparing your readers for it. You hint that Kerry were beaten the last time because they underestimated Galway. Perhaps they did, but surely that is not an excuse. Underestimating is the lamest excuse I ever heard. You must try and find some other excuse this time, and I'm warning you to start thinking in time. Up Galway, even though our team is drawn from several counties.
With doubts about Kerry's forwards, Galway seemed to be the team to beat in the decider.
Judging Kerry and Galway solely on their recent semi-final performances, the odds should be on Galway for the title game. Had Kerry been subjected to those fierce attacks which Meath launched against Galway, it is doubtful if their defence would have stood firm, and the Kerry defence is likely the strongest part of the team. It cannot be suggested, however, that Galway will have little difficulty in the final.
The Kerry team selection eased the pre-match concerns and also improved the mood.
The fitness of Dan Spring and the return of Charlie Sullivan solved the forward problem. On paper at any rate, I doubt if Sean Brosnan and Johnny Walsh will strike up an effective midfield partnership, but this can be rectified by Kennedy and Johnny Walsh changing places. The only real change in the side is the placing of Tom O'Connor on the 40. Our young players of 1938 have 2 years' experience since. Galway have done nothing of note since winning from Kerry in 1938.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 3.
Pato, writing in the Irish Times, was not ruling out a draw between Kerry and Galway.
Truly is tomorrow's game a battle of joints. Galway are roughly half a stone per man heavier than Kerry. Whatever disadvantage Kerry have in weight is made up in their age average. The champions are almost 2 years younger throughout. Nine players are under 25 years and goalkeeper Dan O'Keefe is the only man over 30. Five of the Galway side helped to win the 1934 final. 13 shared in the great triumph over Kerry in 1938 after a drawn game. Kerry's six backs have remarkable inter-county experience for their years. Coming up in school and minor ranks half a dozen years ago, they have played together in senior ranks for 4 or 5 seasons. Croke Park is as familiar to them as Austin Stack Park in Tralee. All Kerry's midfield, wings and forwards are experienced championship battlers. O'Sullivan's re-entrance may be the key to Kerry's scoring success. A big improvement in the semi-final form is essential, and shrewd judges are satisfied that such improvement exists. Kerry's youth may just turn the scales in a close game. I do not think that more than a goal will separate them at the finish. A lucky score may decide, and another level finish is not out of bounds of possibility.
Irish press contributor Green Flag came over all poetic ahead of the decider.
From the purple peaks of Kerry and the crags of Wild Imal, from the greening plains of Mayo and the glens of Donegal, The confidence barometer is at high mark in both camps, and we will win the last word from South and West. Galway supporters claim that their team is better than it was 2 years ago, but I would not bank too much on this, as the Kerrymen can also claim an improvement on their young players, who have garnered experience since the last All-Ireland meeting of the counties. The men on the line will, I think, play a big part in tomorrow's game, as a quick move at a vital stage might bring victory on its train. The Kerry move of playing O'Connor on Beggs may prove a match winner, but one man never won an All-Ireland final. The game will, I think, be won between the Galway backs and the Kerry forwards. Semi-final form is all in favour of Galway, but Kerry were untrained for Cavan, and Kerry in an All-Ireland final are a different team to the Kerry at any other stage of the championship.
Kerry supporters had to contend with an injury scare leading up to the final.
First note of alarm was sounded when we heard that Bill Casey's ankle was gone and that he would be unable to play. Half the story was correct, for he had badly hurt his ankle on Friday. He received medical attention in Dublin on arrival, and on Sunday afternoon, with a bandaged foot, was able to take his place.
With Casey past fit to play, the side showed a single change in personnel from that which had accounted for Cavan in the last four. Charlie O'Sullivan of O'Rahilly's was brought in for his first appearance of the year. With O'Sullivan at left corner forward, Jimmy Gawksy Gorman moved to the half-forward line. There, Gorman was joined by Paddy Kennedy and Tom Gega O'Connor. A bold move by the Kingdom, for Kennedy and O'Connor were the midfield pairing for the three previous matches. The centre-fielders for the final were Sean Brosnan and Johnny Walsh. Paddy Bon Brosnan was the odd man out. The paper also described how the ball was greasy and the ground slippery. The game resolved itself into a tremendous struggle, football being more rugged and vigorous than scientific. PF, in his own book, Kerry's Football Story, detailed how, before the match and with the rain falling, it was fitting that a Kerry fan sent a duck out onto the pitch, with the bird clad in green and gold. The early honours went to the men from the Kingdom. Kerry had the better of the play in the first half, but did not make their domination count in the scoreboard.
O'Connor got the ball from a free from Brosnan. He was closely tackled by Beggs, but managed to get in his kick, and the ball sailed between the uprights for Kerry's opening point after 15 minutes. Dillon sent back and Kennedy fielded cleverly. He left with Kelly, who was fouled. Mert took the kick and Spring got the ball in a goalmouth cluster. A high overhead kick landed on top of the net for Kerry's second point after 20 minutes. Galway were awarded two frees, one after another. Dunn took the second, about 45 yards out, and drove just above the bar. Brosnan burst through and held the clearance, but the ball went inches wide. From a free by Brosnan, Spring got possession and lobbed out to Sullivan near the corner. From a difficult angle, Sullivan sent up the white flag. Flavin got the kick out and sent a nice pass towards Nestor. Myers intercepted, but Higgins came across and secured. He was fouled in front of the post, and from the free, Nestor had a point. Galway had a free near the centre. The ball landed in a cluster, and Duggan got his boot to it. The leather crashed past O'Keefe into the net.
That goal left Kerry behind at half-time, 1-2 to 3 points. The Kingdom were unlucky to be losing, having had the better of the play. However, their display alone meant that they were far from out of proceedings. Having failed to convert their first half opportunities, Kerry set about righting that wrong in the second period.
Casey sent back the free kick and P.B. Brosnan fielded and from a sharp angle drove between the uprights, reducing Galway's lead to a point. Galway had a free under the drop of the ball and then another. Mulholland got Dunn's second kick and made tracks towards the Kerry post. He banged a hard low shot to the net, but O'Keefe saved. O'Sullivan secured close to the sticks. He was brought down. Kelly made no mistake with the kick. And when the ball went between the sticks, the scores were level after a quarter of an hour. 1-2 to 5 points. Galway came away in a great burst. Burke, with a grand drop, sent the Westerners a point in front. Gorman was in possession when he was fouled close in. M. Kelly took the kick and up went the white flag to make the scores level once more. With time almost up and the scores level, Kerry went off in one last do-or-die rally. Kennedy sent in a long ball. O'Sullivan rushed out and secured it. Excitement knew no bounds as the Kerry sharpshooter steadied himself about 40 yards out. A grand left punt sent the white ball just above the bar, giving Kerry a point lead.
It was a lead that would not be relinquished. That sensational finish meant Kerry had retained the Sam Maguire.
More glamorous teams have represented Kerry, but the present 15 are as gallant a band as ever wore the green and gold. They have grit and determination to spare.
The 7 points to 1-3 victory gave Kerry their 14th title, equaling Dublin's tally at the top of the standings. It also secured back-to-back championship successes. Furthermore, the victory afforded Kerry revenge for their 1938 final defeat to Galway. The Irish press described Charlie O'Sullivan's last-minute winner as a gem of opportunism and quick thinking. The press believed the match to be
a robust, rugged game that was marred by the frequent sound of the whistle. There were good patches, certainly, and the huge crowd had a surfeit of thrills in a neck-and-neck struggle, with only a point dividing the sides for long stretches of the hour. Too often the flow of promising moves was broken by the referee's whistle. The crowd had resigned themselves to a draw, when Kerry, in one of their traditional last-minute rallies, swept down onto the Galway lines. Charlie O'Sullivan managed to throw the Galway full and, pivoting in a flash, raised the ball to swing over the point, which clinched the issue. It was a dramatic climax to a game in which Kerry were parked for long stretches in Galway territory but could not penetrate the Western defence. Kerry claimed a pull at midfield for most of the hour, while their half line of defence was more than a match for the Western half forwards.
The Irish Times GAA correspondent Pat O believed
Kerry deserved their win and youth played its part in the final assaults. It was a master stroke of strategy to bring in O'Sullivan to full forward near the end. Around midfield, Sean Brosnan and Walsh struck up a fine partnership. Kerry's backs were again of rock-like steadiness, and Casey, Cohan and Healy in particular commanded Galway's strong forwards throughout. Players were over-keen from the first breakaway. Tackling was deadly earnest, and a few players were not over-particular about rules. There was plenty of life and vigour throughout between perfectly matched sides.
Paddy Foley, writing in The Kerry Man, reminded us of the dedication to the Kerry cause.
There was the man I travelled portion of the way home with. He had left Valentia Island on Saturday morning and hoped to get back on Monday. His journey was by boat, foot and train.
PF went on to laud the efforts of his fellow countymen.
Few impartial critics will deny that Kerry were the better team and deserved victory. Kerry showed a vast improvement on their semi-final display and should have won by a bigger margin than 1 point. It was fortunate for Kerry that Casey was able to take his place in the defence. Considering his handicap, he played a marvellous game. Brosnan once more proved he is a Croke Park footballer and got all the high balls in this sector. Walsh, as usual, did horse's work, and it was Kerry's superiority hereabouts which turned the scales. Best of the Kerry attackers was O'Connor, and he must be voted a pronounced success on the 40. His forcing methods paved the way to many Kerry scores. The game was more remarkable for the vigour with which it was fought than the skill displayed.
The champions, captained by Dan Spring, returned home the following day.
A large crowd gathered at the Tralee railway station on Monday night. Loud cheers were raised as the train steamed in, and there were individual ovations for the different players as they emerged from their carriage. An escort of torchbearers fell in after the cup and to the strains of the Strand Street fife and drum band. The cheering crowd marched to Strand Street, the home of the O'Rahillys, whose club had the honour for the first time in its history of nominating the captain of a champion Kerry team. A huge bonfire blazed at the railway gates in Upper Strand Street, and there was much rejoicing.
The Ghost Train to Croke Park by Sigerson Clifford. I'm living here in London, not as young then as I was, and the poor skull neatly tonsured at the top, and the crow's feet at the corners kicking strongly for my ears. I'll be lucky if 'tis at my ears they stop. But this London that I mention, though 'tis fair enough by day, can be lonely as a fiddle after dark. Ah, old town beneath the mountain, 'tis in poor I was but rich, on the night we took the ghost train for Croke Park. Wish a God be with you, Kerry, where they never lock the fire, with the kettle singing on the sooty crane, and my mother. Will you hurry up now and leave the mirror sound? Mike O'Leary's passing Hurley's with the train. Then the quick run out the half door of the housheen down the lane, and I dressed as neat as any excise clerk, with the blue suit and the brown boots and the medal on its chain, the night we took the ghost train to Croke Park. I mind it all so clearly when the stars danced on the hills, with their faces scrubbed and shiny and the powder in their hair, and the tide across the sandbanks turning lazy in its sleep, and the lonesome curlew bubbling here and there. We all met at Keating's Corner, when 'twas midnight by the clock. Casey's mouth organ made music like a lark, and we gave the Kerry war cry as we marched north two by two to leap aboard the ghost train for Croke Park. And the rear roar at the station, faith, 'twas better than Puck Fair, with the shouldering and shouting and the din. We had bottles full of lemonade and biscuits for the boys, and a brew begun e'en stronger for the men. Dan Keefe blew on his whistle, and he waved the green flag high. Beyond by Foxy Jack's place, I could hear a shepherd bark, and we shouted good for Kerry at the inoffending sky, as the ghost train left the station for Croke Park. We spread a coat between us, and we handed out the cards. Sure, we always brought the deck for 31, but 'tis talk we did, not gamble, for with football in our brain, the card game closed as soon as it began. Bob Doyle, who knew his football, swore that we'd win by a goal. The tailor felt we'd get there by a street, and myself, may God forgive me, thought by 20 points or so. Wish a five or six is plenty, said John Pete. Their backs would hold us if they leapt up to the moon. And Dave Hanley nodded wisely at Pat Clark. All the experts had the scoreboard chalked. Up here the ball was thrown, in the ghost train streaming proudly for Croke Park. Loud and long we held the inquest, steaming home from Dublin town, and we wrote down who kicked well and who played poor. Bob Doyle maintained we'd win the next time, sure. We still chalked up the scoreboard, and the chalk was green and gold, said the tailor, white teeth grinning like a shark. Sure, we only took their measure, and we'll cut the cloth to scale when we take the ghost train 3 weeks for Croke Park.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
The outing against Clare turned out to be a game which was
so one-sided as to be practically farcical.
Kerry's victory and Dublin's progression out of Leinster meant the pair were to collide in the All-Ireland semi-final on August 10th. The stakes were higher than usual. Not only would the victor earn the right to contest for the Sam Maguire, but also move one step closer to going top of the All-Ireland Roll of Honour.
Kerry had a free about 20 yards out. Mert Kelly took the kick amid terrific tension. The ball hit the right upright, high up. Did the ball pass through or outside?
Kerry faced the prospect of returning to Croke Park 1 week later, but on a coin toss, home advantage was granted to the Kingdom.
Tom O'Connor passed to Charlie O'Sullivan, and a long grounder beat Kelly all ins up for a goal. The ball reached Tom O'Connor. He worked free from a cluster and banged for the goal. The ball was got away from the goalkeeper and eluded his outstretched hands to find a safe resting place in the corner of the net. Up they came to the Kerry square, where a Kerry back fouled. Was it a penalty?